This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Hi, I'm Alex Smith from Radio EcoShock, and that is the sound of forests dying. Is it the last stand for pine trees? Millions and millions of acres of pines in Canada are now red instead of green. Their dead husks wait for the inevitable massive fires in the Rocky Mountains, annual fire seasons that could go on for decades. The cause is an insect enabled by warmer winters, as predicted during global warming. Today on Radio EcoShock, we'll talk with forest expert Clive Wellum to find out if the pine bark beetle will spread across Canada and across species. The jack pines of the prairies and the boreal forest could be next. But this is just one way climate change will rearrange the forests of North America. In our second half hour, you'll join the experts as Dr. Del Meininger says a new climate will rearrange the landscape of the whole continent. Southern tree species will march northwards. Some forests will become grasslands. Others will fail to cope and could be replaced by invasive species and pest plants. All of this will displace long-standing wildlife and endanger the lucrative forest industry. Even the parks and wilderness areas are not protected from the wrenching rearrangement predicted by the government's own forest planners. We've recorded Dr. Meininger's presentation at the 6th Annual North American Forest Ecology Workshop, held at the University of British Columbia in June 2007. Future forests coming up in our second half hour. I'm Alex Smith, and I know you take our forests for granted, like the clothing of the earth. They help us breathe, provide our housing materials, paper, and thousands of other things. Forests are the root and roof of the ecosystem. Will you even recognize the new landscape after climate change and the bugs? To discuss the big problem in North American forests, we have Clive Wellum on the line from the University of British Columbia. Clive, I suppose many city dwellers don't realize the huge changes sweeping through our forests right now due to the pine bark beetle. And the death of vast forests in North America is really a world-class environmental problem. For those who don't know, how would you describe the situation, say, to a person from Japan or Australia?
In terms of the impact of the beetle, it's from an economic perspective, it's going to probably result in significant changes to the economy of the interior of the province. What we're looking at in the short to medium term, probably over the next 50 years or so, is a decline in how much timber will be available for harvesting. And so that'll probably result in some significant changes in the forest industry in the province. Ecologically, it's questionable whether one could argue that that represents a significant negative benefit. These kinds of natural disturbance events have been going on for eons. And so the forest will recover. Whether it's the form in terms of its species composition will be the same as what we've seen already is unlikely, but its basic functions will still be there.
But we do have sort of an emotional response when we drive through an area, as I have, and just seen these long lines of dead red trees. Do you think that's an overreaction as a human?
No, it's not an overreaction. We certainly... the natural ecosystems of this province are an important part of how we identify ourselves as residents of BC and of Canada. It's understandable that people would feel a sense of loss associated with witnessing the mortality that and the scale on which it's occurring. So I don't think that's at all unreasonable. So in an emotional sense, it's perfectly understandable that people would feel that this is an issue that is something we should probably address. But from an ecological perspective, it's it's not a major problem.
All right, and I understand this isn't the first appearance of this plague in BC. It happened on a smaller scale. Was it in 1982?
Yeah, that's correct. There's a history of insect outbreaks in the province, not just mountain pine beetle. There are a whole range of insects that attack forests. In fact, it's arguable that the mortality and damage to forests from insects on an annual basis probably exceed what we witness from forest fires. So these kinds of events have been going on repeatedly, and in that sense, one could argue that it's a natural disturbance.
Can we say for certain that this insect manifestation we're seeing now is a direct result of climate change?
That's a difficult. We can't say that with certainty. There are a variety of factors that have contributed to this problem. The principal factor is probably the fact that we've got a very substantial host population that is at an age and condition that is susceptible to mountain pine beetle. In association with that is one requires the appropriate climatic conditions, principally warmer winters, to ensure that a resident beetle population can overwinter at a size that's large enough such that the next year's brood will be even larger. So in that regard, there have been climatic factors that have contributed to the outbreak in terms of the size of the problem. But whether that's a consequence of what we refer to as climate change is difficult to say at this point.
So what does it take to kill them off?
The population can be significantly reduced when we have either a very cool fall period with temperatures around minus 20 or so, or with temperatures of minus 40 for at least several weeks over the wintering period. That's when we tend to see significant mortality in the insect.
I have to say that I have talked to other people who, well, especially when we've seen these maps of how British Columbia will look in 2050 if climate change proceeds as we think it will, who are attributing the lack of super cold winters in the interior as a major factor in the survival and the continuing of this plague.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. It is definitely a factor. That's been largely responsible for the fact that the population can continue to increase. The issue, though, is whether that represents a climate pattern that's anomalous with respect to historical patterns of climate. We're starting to see certainly compelling evidence of a warming in the climate, there's no question. And so one could certainly argue that the magnitude of the problem from the point of view of climate as a regulating factor we're probably looking at a warmer climate, and that's likely contributed to the problem.
So it could just be a warm spell that might have come along, but it does fit in with what we would expect from climate change, let's
yes,
say.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yes, and from the perspective of climate change, then what we would be probably anticipating is that these warmer periods on a year-by-year basis may tend to increase with climate change. So we would get more frequent periods where the overwinter temperatures don't reach that minus 40 or that minus 40 temperature.
Well, at a North American forest ecology workshop that was at UBC, I heard a report that the bark beetle has now been discovered in a stand of jack pines in the northern Peace River region. If that's true, what would it tell us?
It does suggest that at this point the warming trend that is likely precipitated or contributed to this problem is now allowing the northeastern movement of the beetle into another species of pine. So at the moment, the pine has been largely confined, or sorry, the beetle has been largely confined to lodgepole pine, whose distribution, it's the dominant pine species within BC. Jack pine is a closely related species, and its distribution is principally elsewhere in Canada. Its westernmost boundary is really up in the Yukon, but then there the distribution of pine, though, really spans the entire country. It comes down south, then on a sort of southeasterly band across Alberta into Saskatchewan and Manitoba, and then across as far as the east coast. So the concern here is that jack pine is susceptible to mountain pine beetle. We're not sure the extent to which the beetle can survive and increase its populations in jack pine, but it's definitely a concern that if the beetle does begin to colonize jack pine and cause significant mortality, if with warming temperatures that allows the beetle to then move across the prairie provinces, we'd have a much more significant economic problem.
They must be watching this pretty closely in Alberta and Saskatchewan, then.
Yes, there's considerable concern in Alberta, and they are taking steps to try to, first of all, identify stands that have been attacked by mountain pine beetle within the province, and then to develop some strategies for dealing with that.
I wanted to get your thoughts on another issue here. Another speaker at the conference, Dr. Del Meiniger from the Government Forest Agency, suggested that climate change will also cause a big shift over the decades in places where trees grow. He warned that tree species may not be able to move fast enough, leaving some areas open to invasive species, or even new grassy rangelands where forests once stood. Is it possible these pine forests may not grow back into a useful resource?
The answer to that question really depends very much on the time scale at which you're thinking. Trees are very resilient organisms in the sense that an established stand of trees is resilient against a tremendous amount of mortality from insects. So over the very long term, it's possible that we may see large-scale shifts in species distributions. It is possible that conditions will favor alternative species, and some of which may be invasive. So certainly over the broad term, that is a possibility. My personal opinion would be that over the shorter term, perhaps within the next century or so, I would not anticipate any significant changes in species ranges and species composition.
So the forest industry doesn't have to be thinking in the next decade or two that they have to retool for a different species or apply for new cutting rates, as far as we know.
Yeah, I think at this point, that's clearly a concern for the future. But at this point, it's pretty much business as usual. Having said that, that's from an operational point of view. So from the perspective of the industry and its day-to-day activities, but certainly the government and the universities are very interested in trying to understand how future changes in climate can or should impact our approach to forestry and reforestation.
Well, the industry's been going full tilt trying to cut down the dead forests before they burn, but we've hardly put a dent in it. Just recently, Ben Parfit wrote an op-ed critical of the effort to harvest the dead pine, saying that live trees, the regeneration source, if you will, are being grabbed in the clear-cut operations. What's your take on that?
I don't have first-hand experience with that, at least on a broad scale. The operations that I've looked at on the ground have indicated that any harvesting of live pine is certainly on a small scale, in the sense that there really is very little live pine left in the areas I've been, which is in the interior of BC around Quesnel. But I have heard criticisms of the approach in that essentially we are harvesting live pine in addition to the dead pine, but I haven't witnessed that on a large scale.
Well, let's say the climate has shifted far enough, and we don't get a winter cold enough to kill this pest off for a long time. What would be the worst case scenario?
In the longer term, if we continued with producing large monocultures of pine, potentially we could create conditions that are suitable for another outbreak. That would be one possibility. From the perspective of which tree species are the best suited for a given climatic condition, I think it is prudent for us to consider that alternative species or species mixtures might represent a strategy for us to try to mitigate the risk associated with climate change. So, you know, on the one hand, we are likely to witness sort of natural changes in distributions based on the suitability of climate and habitat for different species. We could, though, also, as part of our management strategy, explore which species might be more appropriate and more suitable to occupy sites in which traditionally they haven't occupied, at least to a large degree.
And maybe, as you say, replant with mixed species just on a precautionary principle.
Yes. And for the most part, most forest companies do introduce species mixtures as a normal course of operations. The idea is just that you are, to some degree, mitigating risk by introducing those alternative species. So, for example, typically in salvage lodgepole pine, the stand is regenerated with a mixture of lodgepole pine and interior spruce.
Is there anything else that you'd like to tell us about this situation?
I think what I've witnessed is a point that you brought up initially, which is there's an interesting gut reaction that people have to when they either see the images of these large stands of trees that have been killed by pine beetle, and then how we're trying to deal with this issue and its economic implications. From my perspective, ecologically, I don't view it as a disaster. As I said earlier, the forest has evolved. Tree species have evolved to deal with these kinds of disturbances. So I wouldn't anticipate, for example, that lodgepole pine would be eliminated from the province. I don't think that's even something to really seriously consider at all. As I said, the functioning of the forest will continue, and species will regenerate and grow back. What the forest will look like in the future, we just don't know yet. But that's certainly an area of active research.
We've been talking with Clive Wellum, a forestry expert from the University of British Columbia, and thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Yep, thanks very much.
That was Dr. Clive Wellum from the University of British Columbia, Canada. Not everyone is as shy as Dr. Wellum about the role of climate change in the reproduction of these beetles. Alan Carroll, a research scientist at the Pacific Forestry Center in Victoria, told the Washington Post, "People say climate change is something for our kids to worry about. No, it's now." He said there is no doubt the cause is rapid warming. Jim Snetzinger, the chief forester for British Columbia, reports the average winter temperature in the province has warmed by more than 4 degrees in the last century. He warned, "Global warming is happening. We have to start to account for it." Evan Mills, a scientist at the Energy Department's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, says, quote, "What we're seeing is consistent with what we expected to happen under global warming. We will expect more beetle infestation, more drought, more wildfires." I can go on for hours with quotes that attribute the explosions of the pine bark beetle to climate change, even in the cautious language of scientists. But what is the point? We know the beetle was previously controlled by winter cold snaps that just aren't happening anymore. Even the most pernicious skeptic can't deny the simple and vast evidence that nature presents. Last week, I tried to call well-known forest activist Colleen McCrory for an interview for this show. As a person who fought to preserve the forests of inland British Columbia, she could tell us the situation on the ground. Strangely, my calls were not returned. Now we know why. Colleen McCrory died suddenly from a brain tumor, Sunday, July 1st, at the age of 57. As the interior forests were clear-cut, some areas large enough to be seen from space, this courageous eco-activist labeled Canada the Brazil of the North. She won the Governor General's Award in 1983 and the prestigious $60,000 Goldman Environmental Prize in 1992. Despite some harassment from the local logging community in her home of New Denver, Colleen McCrory was a giant voice for the forest. She gave her life to it, spending all she had, speaking out for forest life and sane logging practices until the end. The whole environment community is in shock at this completely unexpected loss. Colleen, thank you so much. You are a giant of the times and an inspiration for a new generation. It is hard to imagine the mountain forests without hearing your voice. This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You are listening to the Radio EcoShock Show. The Canadian federal government announced $400 million to fight the pine bark beetle and to help the forest industry adjust to the loss. Natural Resources Canada, the government agency, posts this on its website, quote, British Columbia is currently experiencing a mountain pine bark beetle outbreak beyond any bark beetle epidemic recorded in North American history. This ecosystem-altering epidemic is causing widespread mortality of the lodgepole pine forests, the province's most abundant commercial tree species. At the current rate of spread, 50% of the mature pine will be dead by 2008 and 80% by 2013. The consequences of the epidemic will be felt for decades in British Columbia. The beetle is also posing a real threat to Alberta's lodgepole pine forests and the jack pine stands of Canada's northern boreal forest, end quote. And it isn't just happening in Canada. Pines from Arizona to Colorado are being killed off by various pine beetles and borers. Colorado may lose half its lodgepole pines. As the climate changes, trees lose their natural immunity and defenses. Sick forests go down, and insect replication goes up. Pine beetles have destroyed about 80% of the mountain pine ridge forest in Belize this year. Scientists say climate change brought the stress of higher temperatures and years of water shortages. Reuters News Service reports that climate change scientist Kenrick Leslie blames climate change for this new threat to the pines of Central America. We'll be back in 3 minutes with one of the biggest unreported stories of this century, right after this classic, Home from the Forest, by Canadian folk icon Gordon Lightfoot.
Oh, the neon lights were flashing and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended ended up this way, getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games in an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest. Big jet soars above the canyon streets, and the con men con, but life goes on, for the city never sleeps. And to an old forgotten soldier, the dawn will come no more, for the old man has come home from the forest.
That was Gordon Lightfoot, and this is Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Insects are wiping out forests weakened by climate change. This is just a part of a huge underreported story. While terrorism fills our screens and brains, the real terror is slow-moving, the weak march of species northwards, and the massive extinctions of those who can't adapt fast enough. Today we won't have time to cover the sensitive flowers, birds, and the fungi that will die off unreported in the news. Let's just look at what government planners are saying about the future of our forests in just one corner of the world. Climate change will rearrange the forest landscape in your lifetime in ways you will hardly recognize. This is already happening. Last summer, I went to a favorite campground on a lake in the woods, Lightning Lake, in the famous Manning Park of British Columbia. But there was some mistake. The lake was naked and exposed, with the formerly wooded campsites looking like a Safeway parking lot. The pine bark beetle, brought on by climate change, had killed so many pines that park staff felt obligated to cut them all down before they fell over or burned in a conflagration. Forest planners in BC doubt that our parks will protect the ecosystems they enshrine. As the planet heats up, even by 2050, some forest companies will have grasslands in their tenures instead. Trees formerly found in the south will migrate north, but they won't be able to keep up with climate changes. Instead, we may have invasive species and scrub. We'll hear about these rapid changes in the forests of British Columbia in our feature speech this week on Radio EcoShock. And if you live outside BC, this longtime government forester will give you a lot of clues of what you can expect in your forest or state as the climate change ramps up. We taped this presentation at the 6th North American Forest Ecology Workshop, held at the University of British Columbia. On June 19, 2007, Dr. Del Meidiger of the BC Ministry of Forests and Range explained what the government expects to happen to our forests with climate change, and a few ideas of what we should be doing about it. If you listen closely, the situation is shocking. Whole ecosystems will morph, die, and march to new locations. It is safe to say that modern humans have never seen anything like it. We all tend to unconsciously locate ourselves by the big structures of nature, the trees. When these change or disappear, we feel dislocated ourselves. The impact of climate change on the forests of the world is one of the underreported stories of our times. Dr. Del Meidiger has worked as a forest ecologist for almost 30 years in British Columbia and in Southeast Asia. he has steered the development of the forest ecosystem classification in BC. And now, he urges extreme caution in our planning, just because the future of the forest is so unpredictable under climate change. From the Forest Ecology Workshop, here is Dr. Del Meiniger.
Okay, you've seen the map. This is the biogeoclimatic zone map of British Columbia on the left. And then on the right is what the climate could look like in 2080, so in the 2080s. And that's based on some work that was done recently by Andreas Hamann and Tong Li Wong, where they modeled a certain emission scenario into the future. They took the climate envelopes, which they named by our biogeoclimatic zones as climatic zones, and then projected them into the future. So this is one possibility of the future. It isn't the only one. Just have a look, though, at a few things. Like this green zone here, the coastal temperate rainforest, restricted to the coast, of course, at this point in time, increased quite substantially in the future, mostly because the subalpine zone above it is strongly driven by snow and temperature, and with temperatures rising, the coastal western hemlock climate sort of takes over more of that area. Again, you could look at, say, this northeastern part of British Columbia. It's part of the boreal forest, what we call the boreal white and black spruce zone. And you can see there's not much blue left in the future under this scenario. It changes to a climate more similar to ponderosa pine and interior Douglas fir type forest. And you can also see, I'll just point out one other thing, just this red zone here, which is pretty restricted to the valleys of the Thompson and Fraser, expands quite dramatically, and that's the grassland zones. So there's a lot of change possible in the future. So this one is showing relative increases in precipitation, summer precipitation, because that's what drives a lot of, you know, growth of our forests and other plants. And so you can see from the 2020s to the 2050s to the 2080s, the orange is showing a significant increase in precipitation, or decrease, sorry, in the southern part of the province, but an increase in the north. And one of the things, though, is that although a lot of the models are fairly good on temperature, everything, you know, they're pretty consistent no matter what model you look at, for precipitation, there's a lot of range. So this sort of, we're showing here sort of a 15 or 20% decrease in precipitation, but models have shown from zero up to 40 or 50%. So we have these changing Beck climates, and some zones are changing completely in a sort of span as less than 50 years. So if you look at the 2050s at this kind of modeling, certain zones, the ponderosa pine, SPP, there's the subboreal spruce zone, which is the big zone in the center of the province, and the boreal white and black spruce are pretty much changing completely. Like over 90% of them are changing to some other type of climate. And the zones that pretty much stay as is and even expand are the coastal Douglas fir zone, which is on the interior of Vancouver Island and a little bit on the mainland, on the east side of Vancouver Island here. The coastal western hemlock zone, these temperate rainforests, the green one as I mentioned, and then the bunchgrass zone, that red one. So what does that mean when you're losing, say, when the climate of a zone is changing totally? Well, we'll take a few examples and have a look at that. The ponderosa pine zone, as I mentioned, is one that changes completely. And what it changes to is a bunchgrass-type climate. So as it gets hotter, you know, you're going to lose, the trees are going to have a harder time surviving and the grasslands kind of take over. But there's some similarity between these zones. It's not, you know, a black and white thing. 65% of the species, if you just looked at total species, that are in the ponderosa pine zone are also in the bunchgrass zone. So there's a lot of overlap in that. But also, I calculated some similarity values, and this just takes into account not only presence or absence of species, but also how abundant they are. And so if you take that into account, they're about 55% similar between those two zones. So even though it looks maybe shocking, it's maybe not quite as shocking. The subboreal spruce zone, by the 2050s, only 5% of that area is still in a subboreal spruce type climate. The rest of it is changing pretty much to Douglas fir, an interior Douglas fir, or the interior cedar hemlock type climate. But again, there's some similarity between those zones. The interior cedar hemlock is about 55% similar to the subboreal spruce, and the Douglas fir is 35% similar. Wetlands, the values differ a little bit. More similar wetlands in the interior cedar hemlock to the subboreal spruce zone. But if you looked at adjacent areas, I mean, this is looking at the whole zone, and some of those zones are fairly large. If we looked at the anterior cerebral hemlock adjacent to the subboreal spurs, those similarity values would be higher. And initially, that's what would happen. You know, the decline would change gradually. And one where it's say a little bit less similarity was this boreal white and black spruce zone, where it's becoming mostly like the interior Douglas fir climate or a ponderosa pine climate. And here there's very low similarity, 10% to the ponderosa pine, 30% to the interior Douglas fir zone, and 2% in wetlands, 20% in wetlands here. And so that's obviously a much greater change. But would this even happen? I mean, the boreal white and black spruce zone is way in the far northeastern part of the province. The interior Douglas fir type climate and the ponderosa pine climates are in this very southern part of the province. It's a long ways for species to migrate, and there's a lot of differences there too. This just compares some of the similarities in tree species between those zones, the similarities and differences. So you read across the table here, and this is just comparing, say, then this boreal to the Douglas fir to the ponderosa pine areas. And aspen is pretty much in all of them, although much less in a ponderosa pine climate. It's mostly on wetter sites. Lodgepole pine in these two, not really in the ponderosa pine zone. Balsam poplar, cottonwood in all of them. The spruce kind of changes a bit. No spruce really in the ponderosa pine. We have black spruce in the boreal, but not in the others. And of course, there you have ponderosa pine and Douglas fir in those two.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
On CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You're listening to British Columbia government scientist Dr. Del Meininger speaking about the future of the forests, and not just for this province. What you can hear is what is coming under climate change for forests throughout North America and perhaps the world.
So, as I mentioned, it's a long ways for those species to migrate. So even though the climate is very much like those in a fairly short period of time, it would obviously be quite some time before you would have those tree species migrating that far north. So what will we get when you think about it? You think, okay, we have a warmer climate and it's quite dry, and that's like this interior Douglas fir ponderosa pine. It's hard to speculate exactly, but I think we could see a lot more aspen and lodgepole pine as a dominant part of the landscape, and probably an increase in sort of shrubby grassland type communities, which used to be more prevalent in parts of the boreal. So this sort of thinking about what we might get in the future and trying to think about what we might do about it is in the BC Forest Service, we're calling the Future Forest Ecosystems Initiative. And what we're doing then is it's a fairly new initiative. It's just giving some thought to it over the last year and a half or so. And we started doing some climate change scenarios, of which I showed you some of already, some vulnerability assessments, and we're trying to consider how to adapt our forest management policy. So vulnerability is, as I mentioned, we're initiating a few assessments. It's basically the degree to which an entity is susceptible to or unable to cope with the effects of climate change. And you could look at the vulnerability for, an individual, species or person, a company, a community, a management unit, or the whole province or whatever. And we're starting to look at this for water, hydrology, soils, forest productivity, ecosystem. Just we're in the initial stages of doing these kinds of assessments. In sort of a very general sense, what do we expect in, say, southern British Columbia? As I showed you earlier, it's getting warmer, as everywhere is, but it's also projected to get drier. So we expect, an increase in disturbance risk, fire and other pests and pathogens. We expect an increased pressure on domestic water supply, changes in forest productivity in the sense that with more drought, there'll be probably lower productivity in a lot of areas, but then with increasing temperatures, we actually might get higher productivity at upper elevations and maybe even some increase in forest. Of course, there'll be increase of forest at upper elevations, loss of alpine, but then we get an increase in grasslands at the lower elevations. And in this landscape, there are quite a number of invasive species already, and there could be significant issues there. This is just a slide that was done by the Royal BC Museum, which shows kind of the grassland zones in south of us in Washington State coming up in these valleys, as I mentioned, previously in British Columbia. Here's a bit of a look at what some of our grasslands look like. And what's projected to happen by, say, the 2080s is a fairly significant increase in that. But trees, you know, are in grassland climates now, and they survive, and they sometimes try to encroach, and they get hit back by fires or whatever. And so there's a bit, in these sort of tension zones, there's always a bit of back and forth between trees and grassland. Well, what's likely to happen over this period of time is these trees will survive as long as they aren't hit with some sort of disturbance, like fire or some insect. But once that happens, of course, the balance changes to grasslands. The regeneration of these trees will be difficult. But what will also happen, say, with fires or something else hits that landscape, is there's a lot of invasive species. So even though we're heading to more of a grassland climate, are we really going to get a desirable grassland ecosystem, or are we going to get more knapweed and other invasives that we don't really want? What I say, a knapweed cheap grass infested mess. But so what can we do about it? Well, mitigation is one thing, and we've all, I think, heard various options for mitigation, from, you know, taking public transit, riding your bike, or whatever. And I'm not going to say too much about mitigation tonight. I'm going to talk more about what our adaptation options are. Basically, you know, one thing we can do is try to adapt the forest to the changing climate. And that's kind of the focus of a lot of this Future Forest Ecosystems Initiative. But there's also, I guess, societal adaptations. I think we need to adapt to the forest response, in the sense that the forest will adapt, and to a certain degree we have to accept the consequences of what happens. We can't predict them all accurately, and we probably, even if we try different adaptive measures, probably won't get everything right. So to a certain degree we have to accept the consequences, and where we can, take advantage of the opportunities. And basically, you know, adapt our expectations and demands on our forests. In sort of looking at what might happen in the future and what our future forests may look like, there's a lot of uncertainty. And there's uncertainty, as I kind of alluded to a little bit, in the models. These general circulation models or global climate models, both terms are used, are fairly broad models. And when you bring them down to a fairly fine scale to apply them to British Columbia, especially to our very diverse topography, we're probably not going to, you know, they're not going to be very precise. What happens in the future depends on the emissions over the next decades, of course. Right now, the models do not give us a lot of information of extreme events, and that's what drives a lot of ecosystem processes. Now, I understand they are getting better, at least in predicting those. And as I mentioned, just the complexity of climates in BC in applying it to those. We don't know very much about the rates of migration for a lot of species, and as I mentioned, there are invasive species issues which we'll have to deal with. We're predicting sort of, like I say, increases in disturbances, but we don't know what that'll mean, and it's more difficult to predict what pests or pathogens, I guess, might come in to play. So what to do? From a forest management perspective, what we want to do is undertake practices now that will kind of ensure forest products and benefits and services in the future. With an uncertain future, that is a little bit more difficult task. I sort of like to think of it, though, as designing an investment portfolio in the future. And in a high-risk environment, I think all of us would go for a more balanced portfolio and not try to put all of our eggs in one basket. So I think it comes down to sort of balancing our resource expectations from the forest and also trying to accomplish a variety of things on that landscape. So that's why I say we should try to be more adaptive. Try more things on the landscape, because that will mean that if any one thing happens in the future, you've still got other things out there that are still surviving and adapting. And we have to have a policy environment, I think, where we can change policy quickly, so that when we start to see something happening, and we have experiments out there that might show what's successful, we can change our policy quite quickly and make things happen on the land base. So part of that too then is doing modeling, scenario analysis, using various ecosystem-based models to predict what might happen and to see what our adaptive responses could be. And I think we really have to have a very well-structured monitoring system. I mean, if we can't obviously predict everything that will happen, and so we have to have people out there in the forest monitoring and reporting back so that we know where things are changing and what's happening, and so we can adapt. And what we're trying to do then is generate policies for more resilient ecosystems being those that can recover from disturbance. They have the capacity to adapt to change. So how do we get resilient ecosystems? Well, there's a few things we could do in forest management. One is, you know, reducing the vulnerability by fire management. That could be just trying to prevent forest fires. It could also be trying to restore certain stand conditions where maybe eliminating fires has caused higher densities and this sort of thing. We can try to control pests and invasive species, so that reduces the vulnerability of ecosystems. And we can try and do what's appropriate for the disturbance regime, which Hamish just talked about. We can try to enhance the adaptive capacity by doing a few things, I think. And one is trying to maintain or enhance diversity. And we can do that in forestry through how we manage species on the land base. You know, what species we plant, what species we harvest, and how we harvest, what we leave behind, this sort of thing. We can also, I think we have to think about species migrations and making sure that we have corridors for migration. And those corridors have to be linked to certain, I guess you might say, parks or reserves or areas where we have a lighter footprint, what I call here just genetic reservoirs, areas of species and populations. And we may, in some cases, facilitate migration, especially for a lot of commercial tree species, trying to move species or populations to a future climate area, taking into account that they have to survive in this climate, but also be productive and under less stress in a future climate. And we may then also try to maintain ecological integrity where we can, but even restore it in some areas where it may be impaired. An example might be the big sage, bluebunch, wheatgrass grasslands in the very southern part of the Okanagan, which are fairly high in invasive species. So those are some ideas of what we could do. And then we have to think about where we're going to do that. And then this is one of the challenges of I guess, scale and time. British Columbia is 95 million hectares, of which 62 million hectares is our forest land base. Of that, though, 38 million hectares is in what we call the non-timber harvesting land base. It's an area that we have no intention of harvesting at this point in time. And about 24 million hectares then is in the timber harvesting land base. And on any one year, we may harvest, a very small portion of that, a couple hundred thousand hectares. Yeah. And so you think, okay, over 10 years, how much area could we change through our forest management practice if we were only doing it on areas that were harvested? And so it would take quite some time to impact even, the whole timber harvesting land base. But you can see there's a much larger area that we are not really impacting through forest management at all. So I guess we have to ask ourselves, do we just restrict our adaptive measures to what we're harvesting in the future, or do we actually take some action on other parts of the forest? So this is where we get into, I guess, part of the talk here, where we think a bit about what is the role of the public then in sort of helping design, I guess, our future forests. Part of what we said already is that, society, I guess, and we'll have to learn to adapt to the forest response. We need to sort of respect the way nature works, not how we might like it to work, and that's sort of thinking about the disturbance regimes. We can have an influence on the direction and timing of adaptation. So as a public, you have a role in that, because it'll obviously take resources to try to adapt the forest. And so how much is actually spent on that is somewhat of a political decision, I guess. So there's an opportunity to get involved in decision-making processes. And I just put a few things down here about some things that we might think about. And one of those is like this water versus timber kind of as resources, just something that Peter Atterwell just mentioned in Australia as well. And you think about the southern interior of British Columbia and the droughts that could happen in the future. So what is the value of kind of the water resource versus the timber resource, and what's the balance? And I think that's where the public need to get involved in that dialogue. I also think we need to think a little bit about our parks and what they are and what we do with them in the future. If climate change plays out the way it's predicted, the parks cannot, they probably won't function the way they were intended to function, which I think a lot of us wanted them to function, which is as representatives of existing ecosystems. That's the way they were designed and laid out across the land base. So obviously we can say, okay, should we try to protect the parks from what might happen? And how would we do that? How would we protect them from fire or pests? Have a huge scorched earth buffer around every park, and even that probably wouldn't work. So I guess we have to say, okay, are you guys going to let the ecological theater play out in the parks of British Columbia? And, do we have to increase our parks in order to have these things? Or do we have areas where we have a lighter footprint, a forest footprint on the land base in order to, help the forest adapt? The other thing I guess we might want to think about is we spend a lot of effort, I guess, trying to protect rare species and communities right now. And I think it's hard for me to fathom that we wouldn't lose species through the kind of change that's going to happen. And so I think what it'll come down to is we need to have some discussion then about, what kind of resources do we put into trying to protect rare species when we know that we're fighting something here. How active do we get in, say, trying to move species or whatever? So those are the kinds of questions I think we need to ask. And when it comes to something like ecological communities, then, it's even trickier, because the communities, the species will move independently somewhat from communities. And so trying to protect a rare plant community might be, impossible. But I'm not saying it is impossible. I'm just saying that we need to have some dialogue around what we can and can't do and what our expectations are. So there's a few take-home messages, hopefully. One thing is, I guess we've tried to say that we need to respect the diversity of BC's forests, these ecological stages. BC is very diverse, and as climate change plays out on all these things, we need to take into account that we have these different stages, and what might be a good idea in one area may not be in another. We try to make the point that succession plays out on these stages, that temporal diversity, is something that's part of the ecosystems. It helps in their resilience and the sustainability of the forest. And, we can't freeze the play in one act, as Hamish said. We want to let these things play out. And, we want to understand and respect the role of disturbance and how it varies from place to place, so these different disturbance regimes. Although we didn't talk a lot about mitigation, I think, we understand that we could all do something to reduce our footprint. And I guess what we feel is that some form of ecosystem-based management is likely the best way to adapt the forest to climate change in British Columbia.
That was Dr. Del Meiniger, a government forest ecologist with the British Columbia Ministry of Forests and Range. He spoke about the planning for climate change at the 6th North American Forest Ecology Workshop on June 19, 2007. This talk was recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. You can find more free forest-related files for download at www.ecoshock.org. We've been talking about the effect of climate change on the forests and the many species of the world. Here's a late-night telephone conversation from Sweden all the way to a crowd in Australia by Dr. James Hansen of the Goddard Space Center and NASA, one of the chief scientists of the United States, about this problem.
Species are already under stress for a number of reasons that humans are mainly responsible for. But climate change, if it followed business as usual, would be a tremendous additional stress on species. The rate of movement of an isotherm now, at least in the northern hemisphere land areas, is about 50 to 60 kilometers per decade. And species will migrate to stay within the climatic zones that they can survive in. But there are limits as to if you continue to... I'll just summarize by saying that the polar species were tending to push off the planet because there's no place colder for them to go. And also alpine species. As the isotherms move up the mountain, we will be pushing off the planet, those species that live at high altitudes. And this is a particular example of a species that's under threat. In the next chart, I have a polar bear as an example of a high-latitude species. But, again, if you look at the paleoclimate record, there have been large warmings several times in the Earth's history, which resulted, and these were typically 6 to 8 degrees Celsius warming, and resulted in the extermination of more than 90% of the species on the planet. And that's probably larger warming than I hope we will get due to human gases. But the human forcing is actually much more rapid. And the other variable that's different now is that humans have erected barriers to the movement of species. So, and there are natural barriers also for Australia. Of course, you've got coastlines. So I think global warming of a few degrees is going to be cause the extermination of many species.
That was Dr. James Hansen of NASA. And we'll have more from this talk that he gave to the people in Australia coming up on next week's Radio EcoShock. This is CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Listen to Radio EcoShock every Friday at 1 o'clock or tune in via the web at www.coopradio.org. Want to hear more? Download all the EcoShock shows or just the interviews that interest you from our website at ecoshock.org. Tune in free to our 24-hour, commercial-free, all-green radio station there at the site. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for caring, and please tell your email friends and your Facebook contacts about this show.
I am a wild one. Martin is my name. I live in the cedars down by the Elsie Stream. I come out at twilight. Twilight is my time to hunt the shrew in the rushes down along the waterline, down along the waterline. My teeth as sharp as razors, my eyes as bright as the moon. Fast as a hoot owl and silent as a coon. Valley, the scent of trunk and bark and bow, the scent of spring, it's ceaseless rain when the rivers overflow. The salmon, they come back here to breed and to die. Nothing in this valley escapes my watchful eye, boys, escapes my watchful eye. Cedars down by the Elsie Stream.
All right, The Pine Marten Swagger by Casey Neal from the album Eye of the Hunter, available from www.musemusic.org. Listeners in the Vancouver area can get their live Earth fix for free downtown at the Robson Square this Saturday, July 7th. It's an all-day, noon to 9 p.m., rain or shine, for local live music and live coverage of the big screens of other Live Earth events around the world. It's billed as the Global Habitat Festival, put on by Friends of Live Earth, and sponsored by a bunch of good groups, including Greenpeace. Get out there on July 7th, downtown at Robson Square, and meet the folks who care about the future of nature.